Okay, to all of my listeners, it's the World Conspiracy Talk Show with your truly host, Andrew P, on Conspiracy Radio up in Castbox, and we'll just take a little short break a while ago. Very interesting, intriguing program today. And today, I think we might go a little extra longish. Okay, so without no further delay, first thing first, I want to say hi to all of my listeners tuning in live up in Castbox. I want to say hi to Panther and hey to Jama, okay? And all who else who are listening from all over the world, from India, China, all over the world, okay? So without no further delay, we get right back to the main point of topic, where we kind of shift the focus a little from who owns the world, okay? So with no further delay, the topic I'm about to discuss or play right now, it's called The Truth About 5G. Okay? The Truth About 5G. Because you know here on Conspiracy Talk Show, we deal with facts and not max. Okay?
This episode of Real Engineering is brought to you by Brilliant, a problem-solving website that teaches you to think like an engineer. Okay, I didn't think I would need to make this video, but people are burning down valuable infrastructure out of fear for their health. I'm sure you have heard all the insane theories. 5G towers are weakening the immune system and causing the global pandemic. 5G is causing cancer. 5G is mind controlled by the lizard people. I don't think I will succeed in convincing many of the lunatics that believe these things, so I'm not going to try. But let's explore what 5G actually is, how it works, and some of its real problems. Today, we're going to learn some interesting things about data transmission science and learn how our ability to transfer data through the air has evolved over the past four decades. Hopefully, we can pull a few of the people on the fence over to the side where rational people live in the process. We have been using different wavelengths of electromagnetic radiation to transmit information for hundreds of years. In ancient Greece, they used signal fires to convey messages with visible light. Today, we send messages with light through fiber optic cables. These cables are capable of carrying insane quantities of information and are the bedrock of the internet. But we can't connect all devices to it, because many devices need to be wireless. To make wireless data transmission possible, cellular networks needed to be developed, and it all started here in Japan in 1979 with the first generation cellular network, which we now call 1G. It began in Tokyo, where high power radio towers would communicate directly with phones installed in cars. These towers used radio waves with frequencies sitting around here on the electromagnetic spectrum and simply transferred the data in analog. Let's see how analog data can be transmitted using a carrier frequency. Say we want to send a sound wave, a simple sine wave of 100 Hz. We want to apply it to an 850 MHz wave, a wave with significantly higher frequency. We can do this with amplitude modulation or frequency modulation, AM and FM. You have definitely heard of these terms before with radio stations. AM applies the data to the amplitude of the carrier frequency, so it will vary the amplitude of the carrier frequency, like so, basically tracing the original wave with its peaks and troughs. FM applies the data to the frequency of the carrier wave, like so, varying the distance between peaks to trace the original wave. To transfer a call using this method, you need a dedicated frequency band, defined by the lowest and highest frequencies used. If another user is using that frequency band on the same tower, then you need to use a different frequency band. The more frequency bands you have, the more calls the tower can handle. This is bandwidth. As the number of users grew, the system's capabilities were continually being stretched. Adding more frequencies to grow bandwidth is an option, but adding frequencies comes with its difficulties. Frequencies need to be licensed, and there is a lot of competition. Weather radar, military communication and security systems, GPS, television broadcasts, radio stations, radio astronomy, aviation systems, and air traffic control, they all need their own frequency bands. in order to gain new frequency bands, companies often had to go to auction and purchase the license with huge capital investment. This was done with every new generation of cell network, but a lot was done to cram more data onto a single frequency band through the years. Increasing the number of users that can use the same frequency band can be as simple as increasing the number of towers. Instead of using a single high-power tower to cover an entire city, multiple lower-power towers could be used. Frequency bands could then be assigned to individual customers within each tower's range without interfering with the same band in neighboring cells. This increased the number of users networks could support, but it did not increase the data transfer rates. At its best, 1G was capable of 2.4 kilobits per second, counterintuitive, because, as we said, it worked in analog. Bits were the units of data. 1G ushered in a new era of mobile phones with the introduction of a fully digital system. Instead of encoding an analog signal into a frequency band, we encoded binary data. If you were like me, this was your first experience with cellular networks. My first phone was this beast, the legendary Nokia 3310. Sure, it could make calls, but digital data allowed for a new form of communication. This was the era a new language was born, TechSpeak, a language of gibberish invented to keep within the 160 character limit and prevent your mobile network provider from charging you for two texts. In English, each character in that 160 character text was encoded with 7 bits. Therefore, a 160 character text contained 1,120 bits. When 2G was first introduced, it could achieve 9.6 kilobits per second. It could handle that 1,120-bit text message with ease, but the 2G era lasted right up to the launch of the first iPhone, and speeds had increased to 200 kilobits per second thanks to improved internet protocols like General Packet Radio Switching, or GPRS, sometimes referred to as 2.5G. By the time the iPhone 2 launched, 3G was the new hot topic. 3G introduced additional frequency bands. It's estimated that in Europe alone, companies paid over $100 billion in auctions to gain new frequencies. But 3G also made the change to a system that fully utilized the method of data packet switching, which GPRS utilized. Packet switching allowed thousands of customers to share many different frequencies far more efficiently. Here, data was split into smaller data packets. Each data packet contains a header, which contains the address of the destination and information on how to reassemble the data packets. Splitting the data into smaller bite-sized chunks allowed us to make better use of the frequency bands available. Instead of trying to find a large gap of availability on a single frequency band, we could split the data into small chunks and send it across many different frequency bands the moment a small availability appeared. Like changing from sending a huge truck of data on a single road to sending thousands of motorcycle messengers over roads with the least traffic. This made our use of the frequency band's capacity more efficient and allowed us to carry more data. As time went on, these protocols improved, allowing even more efficient use of the bandwidth. In 2005, high-speed packet access, or HSPA, which you have likely seen represented on your phone as a H+, was introduced, which increased speeds up to 42 megabits per second. This was labeled 3.5G. 4G introduced a new technology called long-term evolution, or LTE. It introduced even more frequency bands like the 700 MHz band that was previously used for analog TV broadcasts. It also introduced a new way of squeezing more data through the existing frequency bands with orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, or OFDM. OFDM allowed us to send far more data. You are probably familiar with the idea of constructive and destructive interference, where two waves meeting can combine and either enhance or cancel out the amplitude of each other. To prevent this, signals traditionally had to be separated out over time to prevent interference, but OFDM allowed the signals to be squeezed together and overlap, allowing the same amount of data to be sent over a shorter period of time. When the signals arrived, they were separated out and converted to binary data once again. How? I don't know. Magic or math or something. Honestly, the fact we can stream HD movies on our phone without a wired connection should seem like magic to the average person. It has gotten so advanced that we are now struggling to increase speeds without adding new frequencies, but there aren't a whole lot available. So, network providers are now reaching into the bargain bin and taking out frequencies nobody wants to use. High frequency millimeter waves. Higher frequency waves have normally been shunned for these types of applications. Higher frequency waves just aren't as good at traveling. They get blocked by practically everything, including rain. Think of them like visible light. Unless you have a direct line of sight with a torch, you can't see it. To deal with this, network providers need to install huge numbers of transmitters. Studies have estimated that to bring 100 megabit per second download speeds to 72% population coverage and 1 gigabit per second speeds to 55% of the US population, about 30 million utility pole mounted 28 gigahertz base stations would be needed at a cost of $400 billion. Having this many base stations will help relieve congestion over a single frequency band, but 5G will also be using something called massive MIMO, or massive multiple input, multiple output. These are basically just groups of antenna that are listening and broadcasting to the same frequency bands. This would cause interference, but 5G is also looking to use beamforming, which will allow the antenna to aim at your phone instead of broadcasting the signal in all directions. This, coupled with the fact that higher frequency waves can carry more data, means 5G is reaching speeds of up to 1,800 megabits per second in the US. Higher frequencies can carry more information because we are encoding our information into the wave cycles. Our measure of frequency is hertz, but all 1 hertz really means is that 1 wave cycle is reaching us per second. 10 hertz means 10 wave cycles are reaching us per second, and 190 megahertz means 190 million wave cycles are reaching us per second. Because we are encoding our information into the wave cycles, that means we can encode more information into higher frequency waves. Up until now, we've been using frequencies between 700 megahertz and 2500 megahertz. So, 700 million wave cycles per second to 2500 million wave cycles per second. 5G will allow higher download speeds and lower latency. This will be huge for time-critical technologies like self-driving cars that require rapid communication between vehicles in the network and allow even more devices to join the network to create the Internet of Things. 5G has a lot of potential, and no, it's not dangerous. The electromagnetic spectrum starts on the far left with gamma radiation, which has very high frequency and short wavelengths. Higher frequencies and shorter wavelengths equates to higher energy. And indeed, gamma radiation does cause cancer. Anything over here you need to worry about. But 5G is operating all the way over here towards the lower energy frequencies. Yes, past visible light, which last time I checked, no one is afraid of. Yes, like visible light and microwaves, it's possible to cause heating with high enough powered beams of these wavelengths. This is the only non-crackpot theory I can find on 5G that actually sits in the realm of plausibility. The military even used high-powered 95 GHz beams in their active denial system, which just made the people on the receiving end feel like someone just opened an oven door in front of their face, and it could burn people if exposed for long enough. It's uncomfortable and was intended to disperse crowds. This was essentially a focus beam of 95 gigahertz light, akin to a massive magnifying glass focusing light to burn a piece of paper. Because yes, just as visible light can be used to cause heating, so can these wavelengths when used in high enough power and intensity. As we said earlier, these frequencies are blocked by rain, and so they certainly can't penetrate your skin, and these transmitters simply don't have the power to cause heating that would be damaging. They are simply too low power, and there are plenty of studies that show that they are not harmful. If you are afraid of 5G in this way, you might as well be afraid of streetlights because they emit higher energy frequencies. Everyday technologies like this can seem like magic until you peel back the layers to their earliest iteration and see that they are just the product of many years of problem solving, with each successive generation adding more complexity. If you'd like to learn more about the whole electromagnetic spectrum, including which parts are dangerous and which aren't, you should check out Brilliant's course that unravels the physics of waves and light. Inside, you'll learn things like how light can exhibit both particle-like and wave-like behaviors, how much energy electromagnetic radiation can carry, and even how to measure the speed of light. You can set a goal to improve yourself, and then work at that goal a little bit every day. Brilliant makes that easy with interactive explorations and a mobile app that you can take with you wherever you are.
Okay, my listeners, there you are it. And it's called Truth About 5G. And that's the shocking truth about 5G, what the West and many other are trying to shove on people. Okay? And don't forget you are listening to the World Conspiracy Talk Show with your host Andrew P. and the Conspiracy Radio up in CastBox. We all see the modernization of the deep state, the elite conspirators' plans. New microchip, new money, new internet, new online, basically everything online. All cash is becoming a thing of the past. I don't know if my listeners would agree with me, but I think I would agree with it. How cash is becoming a thing of the past. And you can all see through new modern developed technology where people can shop in online. You don't need to walk around with cash anymore. Plus many other things. AI, artificial intelligence. Okay. So, with no further delay, how cash is becoming a thing of the past. And if you doubt me, just open your eyes and take a look what is going on around you. Do your own maths, your own homework, run your own research, just like we here on World Conspiracy Talk Show.
Paying without cash is fast becoming the norm.
I pay even tiny amounts with my card.
It's just easier.
It's becoming easier and easier.
Will cash soon be a thing of the past?
When I think about it, I pay more without cash than with.
We cannot use cash money in Sweden anymore.
Around the world, financial corporations, politicians, and leading economists are working to do away with cash.
So, there you had it, and I will play it back again all over the world, government, economists, business, entrepreneur, and all of them. They are all trying to come in up with a flipping plan and way they have the plan. Long time, it's just a way to give the people how to render cash useless. Micro days, microchip days, are at your feet, new vaccine, it's world conspiracy.
Around the world, financial corporations, politicians, and leading economists are working to do away with cash.
I'd see a future where you will be able to hold digital euro, digital dollars directly.
Use cash money in Sweden anymore.
Around the world, financial corporations, politicians, and leading economists are working to do away with cash.
Okay, you got it. So they are all working to do away with cash. AI, artificial intelligence, world conspiracy, deep state, elite machine, secretly funding, kicking. Okay? So here we continue.
Around the world, financial corporations, politicians, and leading economists are working to do away with cash.
I see a future where you will be able to hold digital euro, digital dollars directly at the central bank.
Who stands to profit from a world without money? And who will be the losers?
Well, I think I can answer the question to that. The one who stands to gain from that plan is the deep state, the elite, the conspirators, the handful of richest people who run the world, and the ones who are going to stand the losers, it's we, the ordinary people in the world. Can't you see?
The central bank.
Who stands to profit from a world without money? And who will be the losers? Without Susanna Schlierer, many people would have problems getting their hands on money. Here in the so-called Swabian Alps, a rural part of southwest Germany, she drives out to villages that no longer have a bank or cash machine.
When I started my training, the bank was still opening new branches. I never thought I would end up providing my customers with money and other banking services in this way.
Die Kunde mit Geld und die andere Bankdienstleistungen versorgt.
Her money van serves the outlying areas around the town of Heidenheim. She has specially assigned stops where she parks and then sets up shop. This bank on wheels provides the usual over-the-counter services. It has an ATM and a machine for printing bank statements. Many here are fed up that they have no bank in their area.
That would be much better. Young people like me can use online banking, but I still need cash.
There's no other option in this area anymore. There's nothing.
This is probably just a temporary measure for the next few years. All the banks are closing down branches. It's happening more and more. They're forced to save money.
Just a few kilometers away from Heidenheim is the town of Heltenfingen. The local bank closed here in 2017. And Heltenfingen is not served by a money van. Anyone needing cash here heads to a local inn called the Ochsen.
Oh, have I come at a bad time?
How much do you need?
50 euros, can't afford more.
The manager uses his card reader to debit people's accounts and pay up cash to anyone who needs it. He set the limit at 200 euros. After all, he's not a bank, he says.
Sometimes we go somewhere more discreet to pay out the money. It's up to the individual. Some people don't want others to see that they're taking out money.
Cash on tap, so to speak. His customers certainly appreciate the service.
I'd rather have physical money in my hands. That's right. You can get a watch now to pay for things or transfer money. It'll even give you a receipt. All this is just the beginning.
We are living through uncertain times. I don't think anybody, including the epidemiologists, know exactly how and when we are going to come out of the current pandemic conditions. And the first priority, of course, is to save lives. At the same time, we also have to understand and respond to the economic fallout, because the impact is quite major. It would not be a complete exaggeration to say that what we are living through is a combination of the 1918 flu pandemic, elements of the Great Depression, and elements of the Great Recession of 2007-2008. The priority has to be to stem the tide to the extent possible so that when the pandemic is over, the economy can start returning back to normal. And in the process, we try to protect the most vulnerable people in society. I think most developed economies have the tools for doing that. Where IFC can be more directly helpful is identifying where the global supply chain is most in trouble and help bolster the supply chain so that the failure of a few critical corporations does not spread throughout the economy. In almost all developing countries, there is a vibrant private sector. Our priority has to be to protect that private sector and protect the employment opportunities and income opportunities of the vast majority of the people. So that does require collaboration between state and society. It requires the state adopting policies in order to bolster the safe social safety net, but also at the same time support the private sector so that you don't create widespread failures. It is absolutely a critical juncture. I think that follows from what I've said so far. If we do not urgently deal with the dire situation we are in, it will cause huge loss of life and turn into a deep depression. And how well we deal with the situation depends on leadership, depends on the existing strength of our institutions, on trust and communication between state and society. And it depends on the actions of civil society, media, and other organizations from bottom up, making demands, coming up with ideas, trying to make up for the lack of resources or lack of leadership from the state. I think the onus is on all of us that we have to try to do the best of these tumultuous times.
A world without cash. In Sweden, that's now all but a reality. Whether you're buying a ticket, a meal at a restaurant or cafe, paying for the parking lot, or even the public bathrooms, all you need... We've come to a flea market in the center of Stockholm. There's the usual array of bargains. Most of them can be purchased for very little. But you soon notice that virtually every stand has a sign bearing mobile phone numbers and often a name too. If you find something you like, you just pull out your phone and swish. It's Sweden's very own mobile payment system.
For a couple of pounds for my sister, this one, and the rest, 60 crowns for both.
And you pay with a mobile, right?
Yes.
You always pay with mobile or?
No, card mostly, but like these occasions, it's really good to pay with Swish. Yeah.
So, how does Swish work?
Basically, you just need a person's phone number. So you type in the person's phone number and it will announce like who the person is that it belongs to. And then you will just get notified. Like if somebody swishes me, I will get a notification that the money is in my account.
Sweden's banks got together to launch the service as a joint initiative. The aim is to simplify payment and cut costs.
I never use cash.
From my view, if you can be completely without cash, I mean, I think that would be good.
I hate having cash on me. They just disappear. If you have it in pockets, sometimes I even throw them in the garbage because I don't know where to put them.
The prospect of cash disappearing completely doesn't bother most people here.
Most of the cash that exists today, they don't exist in physical money. So I think we are already there. And when individuals stop using physical money, that's just a very tiny, small step in this whole process, which has been going on for a long time.
There are dissenting voices, but they're the exception.
I'm forced to it. We cannot use cash money in Sweden anymore. At least very, very, very little, because they take it away. So I have to use my card. I would like to choose for myself what I would use. Like this. I don't want to use a card here because I don't know the people who work here and I feel not safe to use my cards, especially not my credit card.
A world away from the big city, Lynn runs a gas station on one of Sweden's countless small islands. She still accepts both cards and cash.
We would say I prefer the credit cards. We try to keep the cash amount as low as possible. We have this safety box here, but there's also risk with the cash. If I see as a merchant, the expense on handling the cash is now higher than my credit card expenses. I would say I prefer if they use a credit card.
Once a week, Lynn counts up all her cash takings and fills out forms. The banks in her area have long stopped accepting cash. Every time she brings notes and coins to the bank, she has to make a special trip. Depositing her cash is inconvenient and expensive. But withdrawing cash is even worse. The bank charges her nearly 200 euros.
A few times each year we need to take out change, and it costs me about 2,000 crowns for just getting coins. I get them even the same amount of money. So it costs me quite a lot during a year.
Drives more than half an hour to get to a place that accepts cash. It's basically a deposit box. For each bag of money, she pays a fee of 20 euros. So, not surprisingly, we wait for cash to disappear. The main beneficiaries of this development are located on the other side of the Atlantic. Conventional credit card companies like Visa and MasterCard, but also new payment service providers like Google or Apple and Amazon. The online retailer has now opened a number of supermarkets without checkouts. Customers simply scan their phones at the entrance. After that, cameras track what items they select. Facial recognition technology allows the system to identify each customer and bill their credit card as they leave. A receipt for their purchases then appears in their Amazon Go app. No cash. It's a trend that's growing in popularity worldwide. Last year, Visa ran a campaign in which it offered 50 restaurants $10,000 each if they agreed to stop accepting cash.
I don't know.
Michael Ryan wasn't able to apply as his restaurant had already gone cashless.
We're ready to go, and we don't serve it. I've been in this business a long time, and I feel like there's a lot of theft when you have cash around. So when there's cash in the safe, downstairs, in the office, behind the counter, everyone's dipping in, everyone's sharing. You share your drawer with another employee, there's cash always goes missing. So it's just like this eliminated theft issue. So that's off the table. But the more importantly, it's like today I was late to work. The place can still open because they don't need to go to the safe, get cash, set up the store. You can just arrive and open up. So it's from an operational standpoint, it's a breeze. It's super, super easy.
A world without cash is not the kind of world Brett Scott wants to see. He used to work as a financial broker. Now he's a writer. He believes preserving the ability to pay with cash is vital.
Cash doesn't have anybody to advocate for it because it's like a public utility. So you have on the one side these highly motivated commercial entities, and on the other hand, you have cash who doesn't have anybody who. Everybody uses it, but it doesn't have an official spokesperson it doesn't have a marketing department. So it's a kind of an unfair battle.
He came over from Britain to attend a conference at Columbia University in New York. The question on the agenda here, is this the end of cash?
They developed this concept of premature champagne.
The conference brought together a select group of financial experts from around the world. None of them believe cash stands much of a chance anymore. But Brett believes the current trend is a mistake.
The best analogy to understand this is to think about cars versus bicycles. If you're living in a world where there's only bicycles, actually, maybe it'll be a good thing to get a car. You can travel further, you can travel faster. But that's different to saying you want to get rid of the ability to use bicycles. Actually, what you want is a world where you have different forms of transport. In a similar way, you want a world where you have different forms of payment. So sometimes in certain situations, you can use cash, sometimes digital. But these guys are not calling for that. They're saying we want a world where there's only digital, or in the transport analogy, only cars. You're only allowed to use cars.
When he's traveling, Brett sometimes pays by card, but he mostly prefers to use cash. This machine does accept cash in theory, only right now it appears to be on strike.
You might force me to use my bank account. You have to swipe it instead. Going to send a message to my bank in England and tell a bunch of stuff to them. They're going to alter all their databases before I can get this thing here. So, and they're going to log this as well. They're able to see this. And now there's this third party who's going to watch what I'm doing. So, but this machine's forcing me to do it. Finally, we got it.
So what role does data play in the whole drive to go cashless? In Germany, at the University of Siegen, economics students are wondering how safe digital payment systems are. Could we become completely transparent just by doing our shopping, where companies know everything about us?
Every time I think, oh no, who will my data be passed on to now? It depends on what website you were on. But often things happen very fast and you've no choice.
When I think about it, I pay more without cash than with. That's just the way things are moving somehow.
We live in Europe, where we have strict data protection laws. So I tend to just be trusting and take the easy way out.
There's also this aspect that everyone does it. You think it can't be that bad if it's so widespread. I think that's a key aspect.
Right now, Germany is still very much a society that likes cash. But the example from Sweden shows how quickly things can change.
It's an issue for two reasons. Firstly, because in many cases you have no choice, which takes some getting used to for people at my age. But secondly, it raises concern because we're losing an element of freedom here. We're allowing ourselves to be monitored.
At the university canteen, students have always paid for their meals in cash. First, they purchase a voucher, then they collect their food. But here too, things are changing.
So you're paying cash.
Students can now pay with an app on their smartphone.
So you're paying with Bluecone? Okay. You still have to check their plates to make sure you've got it right. And what you need to charge for.
Hello.
One hot pot, okay. Blue coat? As long as they're ready, it's super fast.
So what do the students think?
It was super easy and it really saved time. But we were just saying we didn't notice how much it cost. The app doesn't show you that. The money's just deducted straight from your bank account. So I have to look at my bank app to double check how much I just paid.
They might get rid of the person that sells the food vouchers. So there's a question of jobs. But okay, that's a separate issue.
Contactless.
So there you are, one more example of world conspiracy. Okay, so you pay, but you don't know how much you pay, okay? And different from you pay and does not know how much you pay, many are saying it costs them even more to use it to pay more than they would have to pay cash. For instance, it's cheaper to pay for things with cash more and use it, okay?
Payment is not yet an issue in Susanna Schlierer's money van. She believes that's a good thing. Every day she sees how many older people already struggle with doing bank payments online or negotiating ATMs.
Don't worry, take your time. It was because you made a mistake before that the card recorded it, but we've deleted that now, so it's okay.
Okay.
I still need help. I don't like machines.
I don't like using the machine. I don't trust it.
Susanna Schlierer helps her customers where she can. A cashless society is inconceivable to many people here.
The customers want cash. They just can't imagine going to the bakery or the local market and paying with their card. Obviously, there are pros and cons, but if the customers want cash, then I'll bring it to them.
Back at the bank itself, in the town of Heidenheim, staff have to deal with huge amounts of coins and notes. The Germans may still love their cash, but the figures recorded by the banks tell a different story. Customers are drawing up less and less money. Meanwhile, the bank says the cost of keeping all the cash on hand is huge.
These guys produce quite a few tons worth each year. They put together over 120,000 rolls of coins a year using our machines. My goodness, that's a lot.
And that incurs costs which the bank can't cover through the fees that the customers pay.
In our basement, where we keep the money, we generally have two employees working full-time. So personnel costs alone are around 100,000 euros a year. Then add the cost of materials, paper, the machine, electricity, maintenance, service costs. In theory, the rent for the room as well. Money is an expensive product.
Also Geld ist ein aufwendiges und teures Produkt.
Overall, the cost to banks amounts to billions of euros each year. But that's not the only issue threatening the future of cash. The European Union is also playing its part, putting limits on cash payments and threatening to do away with large euro notes. Is cash fast be-
So, there you had it. Have to stop it for a while, pause it just a few seconds. The European Union are the one who implementing most of these laws to limit the amount of cash. Okay? And secretly, they're coming with their new euro $1. Ain't you say it's world conspiracy?
Coming a museum piece. Not at all, says Germany's. But that's not the only issue threatening the future of cash. The European Union is also playing its part, putting limits on cash payments and threatening to do away with large euro notes. Is cash fast becoming a museum piece? Not at all, says Germany's central bank. But the man in charge of cash management at the Bundesbank freely admits things are changing.
There's a clear agenda going on here, and we mustn't be fooled by that. We're talking about a lot of money. Companies earn a lot from non-cash instruments like credit cards. People don't talk about that much. But they're happy to talk up the cost of cash. What they don't reveal is that non-cash payments also cost money.
And here you are again. As I point out and show you earlier on, it does cost money. Okay? And in many cases, many people have an issue with it. Many people say it costs more cash to use it normally when they would just pay a limited amount of cash. So literally, it costs more to use it than when you just take out cash out your pocket and pay. Okay?
Das wird dann eben gerne verschwiegen.
Credit card companies like Visa and MasterCard, as well as online payment services like PayPal and the German company PayDirect, earn their money by charging fees for each transaction. In Germany alone, there are over 20 billion payment transactions a year by credit card or online payment service. It's a global gold mine yielding over a
cash.
So, there you had one more example of the pause. So, every payment you make, every transaction you make on it, you have to pay for it. So, for instance, you buy an apple. There's a charging fee on using it. You buy a drink later on in the day. There's an extra charging fee on it. So if you use it for six things for the day, there's a six different charge that's going to charge on it. Wouldn't it be easier if people have cash in their own pocket so they could just take out and buy for what you want six times? So I want to buy something six times, and I have to pay a fee to buy what I want six times. World conspiracy. All part of the deep state, the elite.
Jing. Credit card companies like Visa and MasterCard, as well as online payment services like PayPal and the German company PayDirect, earn their money by charging fees for each transaction. In Germany alone, there are over 20 billion payment transactions a year by credit card or online payment service. It's a global gold mine yielding over €1 trillion a year. Kenneth Rogoff is a professor of economics at Harvard University and a former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. He says having a cash system also aids crime and tax evasion.
I think it's not that cash is bad, we should always have it, but large notes, the days when we need them are gone. And mostly they're not used for anything good. Even in Germany, a lot of the businesses that only take cash, that's for a reason. They're, you know, not paying all their taxes. People want to get payments in cash. They don't want to pay taxes. In some cases, don't want to have regulations. And I think the balance has shifted where more and more of cash is used for that purpose and not so much for legal activities.
Rogoff wants to see a world where there are only coins and small denomination bills for everyday use. Yeah. He believes all larger payments should be made electronically so they can be monitored.
And there you go again. One more world conspiracy. All large transaction should be wired electronic so it can monitor. That was all part of the plan for mining. That's why they switch from cash to electronics. Okay? It's all part of a world conspiracy plot to keep the people's eyes blindfolded from the truth. Not as he were just saying, the most holders of large amount of cash are people who run business and don't want to pay tax and rate. That's nonsense. It's just a world conspiracy cover up because the largest holders of cash is the people. Okay? So when you implement those plans, it's the people who it will affect. Okay? And there is no law and no complement, nothing which says If your business go electronic, you cannot still run Bandulo. It's all part of a world conspiracy plot just to get people to be on the system. So as it said a while ago, they can monitor the transaction people does.
It should bother the
day use. Yeah. He believes all larger payments should be made electronically so they can be monitored.
It should bother the government that the best and not so much for legal activities.
Rogoff wants to see a world where there are only coins and small denomination bills for everyday use. He believes all larger payments should be made electronically so they can be monitored.
It should bother the government that they're printing these large bills and they don't know where they go. It should bother U.S. regulators that many apartments in New York, Los Angeles, Miami sell for buckets of cash. I mean, really, is that because they're afraid of banks? Is that because, you know, they don't, you know, want to go to the inconvenience of going to the bank and getting a check or doing electronic transfer? No, I think we all know why the payments were made in cash. And that's something we should make more difficult.
As one of the world's leading economists, his arguments have global influence. In November 2016, India made a shock announcement. Overnight, the country's largest denomination bills ceased to be legal tender. Suddenly, around 85% of India's banknotes could no longer be used.
Corruption and the black market are the biggest challenges facing our country. Since coming to power, we've done a lot to combat that.
For days, there was chaos on the streets. Huge lines formed outside banks as panicked citizens sought to exchange their banknotes. What made it worse was that anyone wanting to change significant amounts was required to do so via a bank account, something that hundreds of millions of ordinary Indians didn't have.
So there you had one more example, one more issue, with one more thing. Again, they use the corruption agenda, said it's because of corruption to push that issue. It's all part of a world conspiracy plot.
I can't get any money. The government is killing us with this program. I haven't slept for 3 days. You can't imagine the pressure I'm under.
But the government initiative was certainly successful in one thing. It forced many Indians to start using a credit card and various payment apps. One common argument is that it's a good thing that millions of people in poorer countries now have bank accounts and access to credit and digital payment systems. That's certainly the opinion of Tida Wald, head of an organization called the Better Than Cash Alliance.
We're promoting the shift from cash to digital payments because we believe there are benefits for development, for well-being, to improve people's life by moving from cash to digital payments.
He says the way things were done in India was perhaps not so ideal, but he still believes the direction is the right one.
So if I might get him right, he doesn't believe that the way it was did in India was ideal, but he backed the plan. Wow. Wow. What a guy smart. What a guy smart. He does not agree with it, but he backed the plan. Here goes to show you, it is all part of a world conspiracy plot, deep state elite. And the guy was speaking is from a big organization. I think its name was Fun Without Cash or something like so. So they are all on board. All hands on board. Okay?
They have started a plan called Digital India, which means they're promoting the use of technology into government services. And all of those combined have created a great platform for government, local government, national government, for companies and for individuals to start being more included in the economy. And being at the UN, we believe that we can be a neutral convener among governments, among companies, and among people to make sure that this shift is done in the have created a great platform for government, local government, national government, for companies and for individuals to start being more included in the economy. And being at the UN, we believe that we can be.
And there you had it. And being at the UN again. Okay.
A neutral local government, national government, for companies and for individuals to start being more included in the economy. And being at the UN, we believe that we can be a neutral convener among governments, among companies, and among people to make sure that this shift is done in the best possible way.
The Better Than Cash Alliance does indeed operate under the umbrella of the United Nations and works closely with international organizations.
Yeah, that's the name of the company, Better Than Cash. I don't know about no one, and I don't know, but I think I feel comfortable with cash in my possession more than card or more than chip. Okay? And don't forget, all my listeners, you're listening to the World Conspiracy Talk Show on Conspiracy Radio up in CastBox with your host, Andrew P.
But is it really neutral and independent? Its members include companies like Visa and MasterCard, global corporations like H&M, Unilever, and Gap. They're mainly interested in one thing, making a profit. The initiative is also supported by numerous governments and foundations, including the...
So their main issue is making cash, founded by world governments and other foundation or research they run on this movement and company. Yeah, but they still allow these guys to operate and give them license, even give them a platform and media where to brainwash the public more. World conspiracy.
At of Microsoft founder Bill Gates. The Better Than Cash Alliance wants to see people around the world living in cashless societies.
And we add it again. They have connection with the Bill Gates Foundation. Wow.
H&M, Unilever, and Gap. They're mainly interested in one thing, making a profit. The initiative is also supported by numerous governments and foundations, including that of Microsoft founder Bill Gates. The Better Than Cash...
So this guy has all the big weight players in the world behind him and this company. Okay? Even Bill Gates. I don't think it could get any bigger than that. Okay?
Alliance wants to see people around the world living in cashless societies. Having the option to pay by card or mobile phone is a good thing. Brett Scott believes that too. But he has a bigger problem with movements like the Better Than Cash Alliance.
Of course, it's a good thing if you can have new options for payment and new ways to do things. So I have no problem with people getting digital payments methods when they've been forced to use cash before. But that's a very different thing to saying they shouldn't be allowed to use cash. All right. What I like is to have the option to use both of them. But actually, what a lot of these people like the Better Than Cash Alliance and so on, they're not arguing that they're not just saying that digital payments a good thing. They're saying we should also get rid of cash.
Okay, as he pointed out, and I think I agree with him 1,000,001%. Okay, no doubt. I back him 1,000,001%. Okay, it's all part of the world conspiracy. Deep state, elite, plot, to confuse the mind of the people, brainwash the people, blindfold the people, eyes, keep the people brains wrapped up in mental chains. Okay? Yeah. Which lead me to our next issue. Serious issue. Is these earthquake, NASA, and these detection department people telling us are real? Or is it fake? Or is it deeper than we know? If you doubt me, pay attention to this.
This is the Rion Antirion Bridge in Greece, one of the longest bridges in the world. It crosses some of the most active earthquake fault lines in Europe. It also sits in a powerful natural wind tunnel. And there's nothing solid at the bottom of the sea to build it on. To make matters worse, this coast is moving away from that coast every day. How did they ever build it? They face what would have been an impossible challenge if it weren't for some unusual connections. The hammock.
Well, let's let it rip.
A fizzy pop can.
Oh no! There's a fire!
Well, this is lovely. That's a boggin. Indian incense.
These contain an oil that really does smell lovely.
And a steel chimney.
A KQED HD production.
Miles north of San Francisco, a sprawling tangle of power plants, pumps, and pipes work nonstop to mine steam from the ground and convert it into electricity.
The geyser has been producing geothermal power since the 1960s. It produces enough power to power all of San Francisco, about equivalent to one medium-sized nuclear power plant.
At more than 20,000 football fields in size, the geysers is the world's largest geothermal field. But for nearly 50 years, it's been generating more than just clean, renewable energy.
This green line dashed line here is the amount of earthquakes over magnitude 1.5, and you see it has a pretty good correlation with the amount of fluid injected here.
The injected fluid is roughly 20 million gallons of treated wastewater from nearby Santa Rosa and Lake County that are pumped daily into the ground to replenish the steam fields.
The importance of this is it allows us to really say, all right, human activity is causing the activity of the earthquakes.
That's right. Humans can actually cause earthquakes.
The crust of the Earth is essentially in a state of natural tectonic stress that brings it close to the point at which natural earthquakes can occur. And all it takes in most areas is a little extra push, a little extra stress introduced in the right way on pre-existing faults and fractures to cause small earthquakes.
That little extra push happens when humans mine, pump, drill, and dam to generate energy. The oil and natural gas industry, for example, has been generating earthquakes for decades.
In the 1930s and 1940s, near Long Beach, California, although there were a lot of earthquakes, or seismicity as we call it, associated with oil production, the real smoking gun was when you could stop the seismicity by putting water back into the ground to replace the oil. So that's when people say, oh, it's really human activity, this guy's in this. It's not a coincidence.
The earthquakes are a byproduct of a process called hydrofracture to extract oil and gas. The pressurized fluid opens up the oil and gas-rich rocks, pushing them apart. And as the rocks move, energy is released, generating small earthquakes. Even filling up a reservoir behind a dam too quickly can cause earthquakes, and occasionally to deadly effect.
And putting water behind dams, you cause a greater loading on the earth. And if there happens to be some faults there, pre-existing faults, then you can cause larger earthquakes. For example, in India, at Koyna Dam, there was over a magnitude 6 earthquake that killed over 200 people.
That was in 1967. More recently, some suspect that a dam built in Sichuan, China, may have hastened the arrival of a 7.9 earthquake that killed tens of thousands in 2008.
If you happen to go to an active fault, that active fault will naturally produce large earthquakes. And if you perturb it at the right time and in the right place, you might trigger that natural earthquake sooner rather than later.
The risk of a similarly massive earthquake ripping through the Bay Area triggered by geothermal work at the geysers is not likely, according to scientists.
If you look at the San Andreas Fault, it's hundreds of miles long, and we have big earthquakes along that fault. The faults and fractures up at the geysers are very small. They range from maybe tens of meters to hundreds of meters long, maybe a kilometer long. And that's not large enough to support a large earthquake up at the geysers.
I think I agree with the people on the report first. Why? Because over and over, we have learned you cannot trust these scientists. These guys will say anything just to get their way. Okay? These guys have been mastering the craft of manipulating the fact through the media. Okay?
Maybe not, but the sheer number of the earthquakes at the geysers is staggering.
This is an animation of about a month's worth of data from a geothermal well at the geysers. It's about 750 events here. The largest one here is about a magnitude 2, but the great majority are less than a magnitude 1 or around a magnitude 1.
Most of the quakes are too tiny for people to even feel, but some can be felt 3 miles away from the geysers in Anderson Springs, keeping some residents up at night, quite literally.
We average earthquakes of magnitude 2 or larger about one a day. And of earthquakes that people can be woken up with that will shake the house pretty strongly, that's easily every couple of days.
Hi, Jeff.
So this is not a once in a blue moon thing. This is a constant problem that has really changed people's lives.
As president of the Anderson Springs Community Alliance, Jeff Gosby visits with neighbors to see the toll the earthquakes take on their property and peace of mind.
Look at this.
Wow. So this actually goes not only through the cinder blocks, but into the actual poured foundation.
By the way, there was an earthquake not too long ago that hit and it woke me up. My heart was pounding and I didn't get to sleep for the rest of the night because of the adrenaline rush.
According to Gosby, those adrenaline rush inducing earthquakes are on the rise.
Going back to 1975, up until 2003, there'd only been 9 magnitude 4 earthquakes. We've had 15 magnitude 4 or larger earthquakes since 2003. Even though we're assured that earthquakes above a 5 can't be created here, what if larger earthquakes do happen?
9 miles away, Calpine, the largest company working at the geysers, is expanding operations with a new way to tap the Earth's bounty of heat.
Calpine has started a project called an Enhanced Geothermal System, or EGS project, in the northwest portion of the geysers. We're going to inject water into an area about 11,000 foot depth. And that area is very, very hot. What it will allow us to do is tap heat at the geysers that was previously unavailable.
If enhanced geothermal systems can be developed, all we need to do is to find the hot rock, which is ubiquitous almost everywhere in the western United States.
Geothermal energy generates very little smog or greenhouse gases. And unlike solar or wind, it can produce electricity 24 hours a day. The Department of Energy estimates that enhanced geothermal could generate 10% of the nation's electricity needs. But it's not without challenges. For one thing, in a traditional geothermal field, the steam already exists. But in an enhanced geothermal system, the steam reservoir must be created. Man-made earthquakes are a consequence of microfracturing the hot, dry rock to circulate water through it and pick up the heat.
Just by the nature of fracturing rock, you are creating microearthquakes. The approach is to create a lot of very small earthquakes, many of which will not be felt. We're putting additional seismic monitoring in this area to really be able to pinpoint where the fracturing is taking place to effectively generate steam.
Ernie Major from the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory is working with Calpine to monitor the seismic activity in real time.
I'm standing next to a seismic monitoring station. It takes the signal from a geophone that picks up the motion of the ground. And that motion of the ground is then transferred into this box.
The incoming data then allows rapid communication of quake activity, not only at the geysers, but at six other federally funded enhanced geothermal sites.
Hey, Steve, this is Ernie. We've been noticing quite a bit of seismicity, a lot of earthquakes going on at Raft River. Do you see that?
Yeah, I see that there's some earthquakes there, but they're coming from outside of our network.
The engineers can scale back the water injection if the earthquakes are getting too big.
Well, let's keep an eye on it and make sure that things don't get out of hand.
Managing the size of the earthquakes is not only vital to the success of the projects, it's also vital to public acceptance. In 2006, an enhanced geothermal project was shut down after it triggered a 3.2 earthquake in downtown Basel, Switzerland. Motivated by the Basel experience, Ernie Major helped write a set of federal guidelines to help manage the risk of induced seismicity.
You don't want to put it close to a very large fault. You don't want to put it in the middle of a large city. The industry has finally woken up to the fact that induced seismicity is a major issue and it could be a deal breaker if not dealt with properly.
Calpine is heeding the advice while moving full steam ahead.
We do not believe this enhanced geothermal system will create an increase in felt earthquakes. If you look at the active faults in the area and you look at your injection and production activities, I think it's an appropriate risk in order to capture the benefits of this large renewable energy resource.
And as we work to reduce our
So if I may get him right, it is appropriate risk, okay, for they to provoke the earthquake just to get their energy and other things they want out of the earth to give to people. Wouldn't you call it ironic? Or is just part of a world conspiracy? So literally he's trying to say nothing is wrong with what they are doing. Okay? Yeah, because it's a little minor thing comparing to people who need the energy. It's all deep state elite back. Okay, these people take ordinary people in the world for a fool. Okay, that is the reason why he could tell us in front of our face that it's appropriate to create those man-made effects, triggered off earthquake, that maybe can kill millions of people if triggered off the wrong one. But it's appropriate. World conspiracy.
To capture the benefits of this large. You look at your injection and production activities, I think is an appropriate risk in order to capture the benefits of this large renewable energy resource.
And as we work to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels while meeting growing energy demands, the need to strike a balance between risks and benefits grows more urgent.
Any source of energy production, including renewable energy, has its benefits and drawbacks. And the energy mix the United States has in the future will depend on the choices we make regarding how we balance those benefits and drawbacks, whether it's solar energy, wind, nuclear, hydropower, or geothermal.
So there we had it. Okay. And for all of my listeners, if you doubt it, or you feel it is just a one-off tape or something which is just World Conspiracy Talk Show saying it, which is probably the make of that, well, you have shocking news coming to you. Okay? So with no further delay, pay attention to this. Serious Bakitiv.
A pair of new earthquakes is rattling nerves this morning in Oklahoma. Both are a greater than 4 magnitude and struck near Crescent, that's north of Oklahoma City. There are no reports, though, of damage.
The first quake hit just hours after the release of a disturbing new government report that showed seismic activity in parts of the country's midsection are now as dangerous as in California.
Oklahoma, land of steak, country singers, tornadoes, and recently,
earthquakes. In the past, the average person might have felt one or two a year, but that number is skyrocketing. Last year, the state had 3 times as many quakes as California, and signs are pointing to even more this year. If that isn't the work of a supervillain, what is behind the shaking?
America has always sat on a bounty of oil and gas, but a lot of it was trapped in a type of rock called shale. About a decade ago, techniques to extract it got more affordable, helping trigger the oil and gas boom.
And today, America is number one in oil and gas.
25% of all new jobs created since 2010 all came from oil and natural gas reliance. It is the backbone of Oklahoma.
Shale state economies thrived, and these days,
prices plummeting at the pump.
But drilling has had unexpected repercussions. See, when oil and gas get pumped from the ground, massive amounts of toxic water come up with it. To dispose of it, companies inject it back deep into the earth. Out of sight, out of mind, theoretically. But sometimes that wastewater can add pressure to existing faults, causing them to slip, triggering earthquakes. This is
So there you are it. There you go. So many of these disasters you see in the world and you might feel or think it is God made that is happening. I ain't saying that God cannot do it, but most of the times these guys interfere with a lot of natural things that God made and leave and try to blame the blame on God. In order to reach the gas and the oil, they have to dig through the shale rock, which they are literally digging too deep through the core of the earth. So they call it the man-made earthquake. These are the informations and the things that they keep hidden from us. Teachers don't teach you these things in schools. Preachers does not tell you about these things in church. Media does not bring these reports in news. If they even do, they bring it at last second. Okay? These are the hidden world conspiracy, deep state, elite.
Happening in many places, but Oklahoma is getting the worst of it.
one that hit last night was the strongest in state history.
In 2011, disposal wells sparked an earthquake that damaged more than 200 buildings. The wells were not new. One of them had been active for 17 years before the quake. So even if all disposal wells were shut down today, the shaking probably wouldn't stop. That might take years, maybe decades. Humans have induced earthquakes before, but disposal wells are the biggest culprit of man-made quakes today. The oil industry says pinning all the blame on them is unfair. Those earthquakes could be natural or caused by something else. We just don't know yet. Meanwhile, water keeps getting pumped underground, even near proven earthquake zones. Maybe we should all take a hint from what's going on, as the risks of ignoring science could be seismic.
This episode of Real...
So, here you are, it. Here you go. It's the World Conspiracy Talk Show and Conspiracy Radio up in Castbox with your host, Andrew P. Where it get deeps and deep, the rabbit hole get deeper, and we follow the rabbit down the hole. So we see these guys create all kind of scenarios, all kind of problems, all kind of solution. They say one create the problem, then they are telling us about the solution. Okay? So we see how these guys continue years upon years, decades upon decades, brainwashing the people, blindfolding the people's eyes, of the mental and physical world and the people. Okay? Which lead me to our next thing. And a serious thing, a serious issue. Very, very serious issue with these guys, Bill Gates, co-corporate and companies, deep state elite, just Bill Gates with the new Bluetooth apps and the vaccine. And everything will be all right. It's all part of a world conspiracy, deep state, elite. And if you doubt me, pay a key attention to this piece of information.
This episode of Real Science is brought to you by Brilliant. Master concepts in math and science for 20% off by being one of the first 200 people to sign up at brilliant.org/realscience. At this point, no one is oblivious to the impact the novel coronavirus is having on society. Millions infected, tens of thousands dead, financial markets in ruin, people out of work, social isolation, and everyone wondering, when will this end? And this is the hardest question to answer. We are in uncharted waters. Currently, experts estimate the worst of the impact should be over in a few months. But even after this initial surge is over, there is a chance that the virus will persist in the population, coming back again and again. There is also a chance that the virus could act seasonally, recurring every winter. Scientists and, well, everyone, fiercely hope that this isn't the case. But there's a possibility it just doesn't go away on its own. And even after only a few weeks, everyone can feel that this lockdown is unsustainable. If the virus does come back again next year, the prospect of shutting the world down again is devastating. There is an urgent need to find a way to prevent new infections. And because of this, the race for a vaccine is on. Right now, there are at least 35 different vaccines in preliminary stages around the world. Researchers are moving at breakneck speeds, and progress is being made ridiculously fast. And the most promising vaccines right now are ones that are very different from the traditional vaccines we all know about. This type of vaccine is called an RNA vaccine, and if successful, could revolutionize the way we prevent infectious disease. Just like normal vaccines, RNA vaccines get the body to produce antibodies which can attack potential pathogens, but they do so in a totally different way. And scientists think that this simple yet groundbreaking concept could be the way to stop coronavirus in its tracks.
And before we go further, I have to pause to say, you heard she said, and because she's quoting exactly what they said, and scientists think it will, they think. So they have no independent way of verify, no source, no research, nothing, but they think. And I'm going to play it back, they think. Well, you know, I think these guys need to take a bath. Yeah, I think these guys need to take a bath, because they think too much. Okay? They produce no facts, no evidence, but they think.
Could revolutionize the way we prevent infectious disease. Just like normal vaccines, RNA vaccines get the body to produce antibodies which can attack potential pathogens, but they do so in a totally different way. And scientists think that this simple yet groundbreaking concept could be the way to stop coronavirus in its tracks. Vaccines are one of medicine's greatest inventions and prevent an estimated 2 to 3 million deaths every year. Vaccines have eradicated smallpox, reduced global child mortality rates, and prevented countless birth defects and lifelong disabilities, such as paralysis from polio. Historically, vaccines work by introducing a weaker form of the virus to the body, or by introducing a dead form of it. These are called live attenuated vaccines and inactivated vaccines. The virus's disease-causing traits are removed before being injected into the body. When these modified versions of the pathogen are introduced to the body, the immune system recognizes the antigens that coat their surface, just as the body would in an actual infection.
So there we go, one more time again. Here we go again. So literally, they are saying they are going to inject you with another virus to get rid of a virus. Oh my gosh. Ain't it world conspiracy, deep state, elite plans? So if I am to get this right, they are going to inject us with the next virus to get rid of a virus. What a world conspiracy.
These are called live attenuated vaccines and inactivated vaccines. The virus's disease-causing traits are removed before being injected into the body. When these modified versions of the pathogen are introduced to the body, the immune system recognizes the antigens that coat their surface, just as the body would in an actual infection. The immune system reacts to these antigens by making certain types of white blood cells called T cells and B cells. T cells attack cells in the body that have already been infected, and B cells produce antibodies that attack the viral antigens. The antibodies bind with the antigens on the modified pathogens, just as they would with the disease-causing pathogens. This blocks them from infecting more cells and allows the body to destroy them. Once the vaccine pathogens are destroyed, the body is left with a supply of T and B cells that will remember how to fight that specific disease in the future. This type of vaccine can be very effective at preventing certain diseases, but the way they are manufactured means they are not always a great solution when a novel sudden outbreak like the coronavirus happens, because making these vaccines often takes a huge amount of time and resources. The seasonal flu vaccine provides a good example as to why the process is cumbersome, because the key to making it is lots and lots of eggs. Egg-based vaccine manufacturing is used to make both the inactivated vaccine, the flu shot, and the live attenuated vaccine, the nasal spray vaccine. And they have been making them this way for the last 70 years. The process begins when the candidate flu virus is injected into fertilized chicken eggs. They are then incubated for several days to allow the viruses to replicate. For inactivated influenza vaccines, the viruses are then killed and the virus antigen is purified. For live attenuated...
So, all my listeners, do you get that carefully? So you see the amount of process and all kind of things these guys have been putting in people. They have to inject a different version of the virus where they claim that they take out few things out of it and inject it in a chicken egg. And then when it reached to another level, then they take out the egg or what they want out of the egg and do what they want with other things and other galangin. You see the same problem I have with this vaccine and these people. Can't you see these people are taking us for fool?
several days to allow the viruses to replicate. For instance, the process begins when the candidate flu virus is injected into fertilized chicken eggs. They are then incubated for several days to allow the viruses to replicate. For inactivated influenza vaccines, the viruses are then killed and the virus antigen is purified. For live attenuated vaccines, the process is even more involved. They have to be modified to no longer be infectious to humans, but remain similar enough to the original virus to produce an immune response. This is done by allowing the virus to mutate over time inside the chick cells. It slowly becomes more adapted to infect chicken cells and less adapted to infect human cells. Then, when reintroduced to the body as a vaccine, the weakened virus multiplies less quickly in humans and gives the immune system time to mount an antibody response. But as you can expect, this process takes a long time. Production can take months, an eternity when there is a deadly virus circulating the globe. Propagating the viruses in question is also expensive and requires a massive number of eggs. It takes about one egg to make one vaccine. Some of the coronavirus vaccine development projects are using these more traditional approaches, but others are using newer technology to try to circumvent these problems. One company, Moderna, is leading the charge in creating an mRNA vaccine that could be the first of its type approved for human use. And the vaccine, called mRNA-1273, could become the first coronavirus vaccine available to the public. The development of the vaccine began when the entire genome of the coronavirus was sequenced in January of this year and uploaded to a public database. Scientists then identified the sequence within the genome for a key protein on the surface of the virus called the spike protein as a good vaccine candidate. The spike protein is a surface protein that the coronavirus uses to bind to a human cell receptor, allowing it to gain entry into the cell. It is one of the major antigens of the coronavirus that the human body can make antibodies against. The nucleic acid sequence that codes for the spike protein in the virus was then encoded into an instruction molecule, a messenger RNA. The mRNA molecule can then be replicated many times and administered to patients directly as a vaccine. The mRNA then travels throughout the body and eventually instructs some immune cells, like macrophages or dendritic cells, to make copies of the spike protein. The spike protein antigen is then displayed on the cell surface of the immune cells that have taken up the mRNA. The presence of the spike protein lets the immune system think it has been infected by the coronavirus. Immune cells then learn about the spike protein and mount an immune response against it. The immune cells that develop then remain in the body and can protect the person if they ever come in contact with the actual coronavirus. This novel approach is promising because the virus itself doesn't have to be propagated to make a vaccine. This cuts out a time-consuming process and instead uses the human body, in a sense, to manufacture its own vaccine. In contrast to the months required to make traditional vaccines, RNA vaccines can be made in the lab in approximately 1 week using readily available materials. And because it is relatively easy to encode mRNA with any nucleic acid sequence, variations of the vaccine can be made quickly too, using the same production methods and manufacturing facilities. This, in particular, could become vital for viruses that mutate, allowing vaccination efforts to be more nimble and adaptable to changing circumstances. A recent study used mice to test the effectiveness of RNA vaccines for a range of infectious diseases, including the Ebola virus, H1N1 influenza, and Toxoplasma gondii. They found that it was successful in fully protecting against lethal exposures to these deadly pathogens. DNA and RNA vaccines have also been used for years in veterinary medicine for diseases like rabies in dogs, foot and mouth disease in cows, and even a bronchitis caused by a different form of coronavirus in chickens. The scientific basis for the coronavirus RNA vaccine is sound. And if it can be produced so quickly, why isn't it already out there? The science of mRNA vaccines may be proven in animal models, but it will still require a lot of testing in humans before it can be released to the general public. Vaccine developers have to be very careful in developing any product that is going to be injected into potentially most of the world's population. The trials need to rule out if the vaccine could be ineffective or worse, unsafe. The main risk that researchers need to be careful to avoid is a phenomenon called disease enhancement. This is when vaccinated people who do get infected with the actual virus develop a more severe form of the disease than people who had never been vaccinated. And this does come up on occasion in clinical trials.
So, okay, there we had it. Thing, there we had it. The new vaccine. And I think we will study this new vaccine personally tomorrow on the next topic. Okay? And I want to say hi to all who tune in. And hello to who, all of who join in. And thanks to all who stay tuned with World Conspiracy Talk Show today, because we have a nice time. Okay? And we will continue this tomorrow at the next time with the next episode. Okay? Bye.